This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. What's it like to work in the Bakken oil fields? Well, during the past year, we've heard lots of oil field voices on Prairie Public as part of the Black Gold Boom series. Today, we continue with another take on the oil boom. Todd Melby, Prairie Public's Black Gold Boom reporter, interviews an oil field poet.
I'm Todd Melby, the Black Gold Boom reporter for Prairie Public. And with me today is Matthew Henderson. He's the author of The Lease. He's a poet, but he also worked in oil country in Western Canada. Before college, he worked in the oil fields in Saskatchewan and Alberta, including working many, many months in the Bakken. His new book of poetry is called The Lease, and The Million, an online literary magazine, called the book a sneakily brilliant, beautiful work. And Dwight Garner of the New York Times liked it, too. He called it spare and elegant. Matthew Henderson, welcome to the program.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm very excited to talk to you today. It's not often that there's a poet who's also has a history of working in the oil fields.
I think that's part of probably why I've had some good response to the book, is that a lot of the time you've got these two separate worlds of academia or art and then this other world of, you know, actual people doing work. So people have seemed to respond to that.
Now, you grew up on Prince Edward Island. How did you make it to the oil fields in Western Canada?
I took the path that a lot of people do from Eastern Canada. There's a huge population of kind of, I wouldn't say migrant workers, but workers in Alberta and Saskatchewan who come from the eastern provinces, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and especially Newfoundland. Not a whole lot of opportunities in some of those Atlantic provinces. So a lot of people end up going out to Alberta, Saskatchewan, and working in the oil field there. Actually, they've got flights and things set up to take people straight from Fort McMurray in northern Alberta right to Newfoundland to get back to their families. I went out a little bit differently than that. My father actually ended up going out and working for, at that point, my deceased uncle's company. And then I finished high school, and there was a job waiting out there, and I wasn't quite ready to go to university yet, so I just kind of tagged along and worked for my first year for that company as well.
Let's take a break from your personal story and have you read one of your poems. How about we hear Service Rig?
Service Rig. Half these men are boys, like you are, but yell so loud the cracks in their voices are hard to catch. The other half, giants, older than the rig itself, they knew this oil before it was black. A bare chest here is thin and folded into itself 1,000 times. You've never seen them take the head off the pump jack. It's clean in the dirt when you arrive. But you get to see the service rig rising, the tongs turn on. Watch the youngest man on crew climb the derrick and stand, harnessed, coveralls dropped from his chest and tied with the sleeves around his waist, up where no one can yell at him to zip up, no one can tell him to remember Charlie, where he can feel the prairie wind beating his chest like the skinny fists of a woman who almost wants him to let her go.
Wow. Thank you. So that poem kind of speaks to a bit of freedom that derrick hands must feel when they're up high.
Yeah, and it's a bit of an imagined feeling too. You know, I've been up on some equipment, but generally I shouldn't have been up there. I've never worked as a derrick hand, so I've never had that feeling, but you know, it's a bit of imagination, I guess.
And for folks who don't know, a derrick hand is the person on a drilling rig who goes up really, really high, and he's harnessed in, and he kind of stands at this platform that's maybe 80 or 90 feet above the floor of the drilling rig, and he's often the guy that connects the pipes.
Yeah, that's right. On a drilling rig or a service rig, and I think that it's from an outsider's perspective, you know, without all of the dangers that you wouldn't understand looking immediately at the rig, he's the one who appears to be in the most obvious and immediate danger, you know, standing up very high. But I think that height combined with the flatness of the prairie is what emphasizes that feeling of freedom, you know, that sense that you can see just until the end of everything.
What effect did the prairie have on you?
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of the time in the book, I'm kind of making reference to this sense of loneliness. And I usually when I'm talking about it, I don't mean it in the sense of, you know, like, oh, I wish there was someone here to talk to, but more the feeling that you are maybe the only person around. And the prairie really emphasizes that. When you can kind of stand there and look out and not really see much of anything, you know, for miles and miles and miles. And when the horizon is just so very far away, you know, that limit to what you're able to see, it can emphasize the fact that you are in, you know, you are the only person around for quite some space.
The last poem that we had you read, Service Rig, touched on the subject of danger, and so does this next poem. Why don't you read Newell for us?
Newell. You can see the smoke by Vauxhall. A short day, a shallow frack. You reach home, but keep driving. Through brooks, past the patch motels, to Newell and its oil-smudged sky. As a child, you painted your face this color. Ash from driftwood burnt on the beach, jellyfish drifting upside down, charting dead angles, the sand against your stings. A blowout, they both guess, Mike in back, King Cab, and the soup driving. It's all sour, too. You hit a barricade a kilometer out, firemaster trucks everywhere, the campground evacuated. Two dead when the stabbing valve went. The pipe swung so fast it took one guy's face clean off. But you only know this later. On that day, you drive with your asses off the leather, so close to yourselves, toes curling after something solid, a foothold inside your steel-toed boots.
So, Matthew, was there ever a case where you were really scared of being injured?
There were a few times. I think that most people who spend, you know, a year or two or something like that in the oil field will run into a situation where they had a legitimate fear of injury. The thing that's more present, though, than when something actually goes wrong is just the kind of the sense of alarm or alertness when you're about to do something, you know, when you're about to light a flare stack, or when you're about to open a well after a frack and you know that there are, you know, 40 MPa pressure on that well and you can feel it kind of rumbling underneath you, and then you slowly, there's that sense of urgency or danger that's always there.
What does MPa mean?
It's millipascals, so it's just the pressure that we use. I guess actually there's a difference in Canada and in the States. So we would be using millipascals. I think you use pounds per square inch there.
Of course, because we're sticking with the old standard English version, right?
That's right. Yeah, I wasn't thinking.
Right. But maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, about the pressure you feel at certain times, how you can sort of feel the power of what's under the ground and that's about ready to come up.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, especially when you first begin doing things and you don't quite understand the actions that you're taking, you know, as a really green worker. And instead you're mostly following instruction. And so when your supervisor, who's got a lot of experience, says, you know, grab that lever and slowly begin turning it to the left. And you can look at the gauge and you can feel, because when a lever is pressured up, when there's a lot of pressure behind it, it becomes really difficult to pull. There's a lot of resistance. And you can feel that resistance, and it's almost as if that resistance is telling you, you know, what you're doing is not a smart thing to be doing, even though, you know, it's exactly what you should be doing for your job. So there's that sense of just, you know, I know that this is the correct thing to do, but something is telling me that this is, you know, a dangerous thing.
Did guys talk a lot about the danger?
Not really. I mean, it's not, you don't walk around frightened all the time. It's just this kind of like very quiet feeling that you would get maybe in your gut. I've had one supervisor who told me, he said that every single time that he would open a well after a frack, he would be nervous, and that he was really worried about there coming a time when he wasn't nervous anymore, because that's when mistakes happen.
Why don't we have you read Wake Up?
Sure. So Wake Up is just kind of a poem about the day-to-day, about what you end up doing when the day starts, when you're about to go to work. Wake up. This morning begins at 3 p.m. You don't shower, the grease of last night's work already collected around the hotel drain. They sell gum in the lobby, your fifth pack this week, just in case she touches your hand as she takes the cash, in case she wants your story, in case she wants to tell you hers. By 5, you're in the truck. Chuck kicks the clutch, you can't drive stick. Cuts onto the highway with serious rock and dirty talk radio blaring. He tells you he had a coke problem, but you learn that's not a problem at all. You barely speak. There are so few things now that could happen to one of you and not both. Tonight will be 12 hours plus 2 driving. There were 12 days like this in the last 15. 182 hours by the end of the night. You don't see lovers this often. You don't see lovers. Halfway there, you start to like the drive. Find deer outside your window in the heat and the air. And though their novelty has faded, you feel skin in the leather under your forearm. The snap of muscles contracting. Bird fur. Like they're leading you to the lease. As if you could be led anywhere else.
That's Matthew Henderson reading from his book, The Lease, and that poem is called Wake Up. There are several things I like about this poem, Matthew, and one of them is this notion of family. I talked to some roughnecks who worked on a drilling rig together, and they really said they spent so much time together that they really consider themselves family, and that seems to be expressed in this poem.
Yeah, you know, I didn't quite have the experience that a roughneck would have working with maybe the same crew for months at a time. But certainly I would work, you know, we worked in pairs normally or in groups of four. And just the hours and hours and hours that you spend together, particularly on a night shift when there's a bit less actual work to be done and there's more monitoring of the well. And it's just the two of you there for 12 hours at a time. And there's just nothing but time. And you really get to know a person very quickly, even through just a few shifts.
Do you get to know the person because you end up talking so much or just through feeling or some combination?
There's kind of a double sense of things, you know. Inevitably, you end up talking with each other a lot. But you get this second sense from being near someone. It's almost like the objects in your house, you know how to move in the dark. You can go to the kitchen and get a glass of water. And when you're with someone for that long, when you're doing the work together, you kind of know that you can reach out behind you without looking and the hammer handle will be put in your hand. And that someone's going to be reacting with you and you kind of respond to each other with less words, which is interesting. And it's kind of a different experience than I've had in any other jobs.
And what about this idea that a guy goes in and buys the same pack of gum over and over, just hoping that the woman behind the counter will say something to him.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of responds to that idea that I was talking about earlier of loneliness. You can get this sense, particularly if you're working away from home. I know that a lot of the time guys will call it a hitch when you go away and you do work away from your home for a while. And when you're on a long hitch, when you're staying in a hotel or in a camp for 30 days or 90 days or something like that, you can start to feel really isolated. And that's that sense. This one is, you know, I can remember a time being put up in a hotel for something like 40 days. And I spoke to my supervisor, and then I spoke to the person who I bought my meals from. And that was it for those 40 days. Otherwise, you're alone. So there's just that kind of sense where you're hoping for some kind of meaningful connection, but you know, of course, it's in vain. You're not really making any connection either.
And so, how did you cope with that?
It's time, you know. I mean, I was pretty fortunate. I did, you know, 4 month stints after that first year. But some of these guys, that's what they deal with. That's how they live for 40 years at a time. I wish I knew how you coped with it. It's kind of a strange, difficult time. I guess you just look forward to that moment when you go home, when you go back to your family.
How much respect do you have for the men and women who are doing this year after year after year to provide for their families?
An incredible amount. You know, it's a difficult job. It was a difficult job for me to do for 3 months at a time. In the book, I talk about the things that you can't have. You know, I talk about how close the relationship is with your supervisor. And with the men you're working with. And if you look at the reverse side of that, if that's where all of your time is, then it's so difficult to maintain those other relationships at home. It's so difficult to look forward to the things you're actually doing this work for. And some people manage to do it, and they manage to do it and not really complain about it or write a book about it. So I have a lot of respect for that.
That's Matthew Henderson, a Canadian poet who's written a book of poems called The Lease about his experience in the oil fields. He's talking with Black Gold Boom reporter Todd Melby. More in a moment.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with two episodes of Antiques Roadshow from South Dakota and New Jersey. Then at 9 Central, I Am a Person, a documentary from Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're going to go back to our interview involving Todd Melby, a Prairie Public's Black Gold Boom reporter, and his interview with Matthew Henderson, a Canadian poet.
All right, why don't we hear about one of the characters in your book, a guy named Dave. Dave talks about this one guy.
This one guy was on lease. The frackers failed their pressure test, and the line split, and he wasn't anywhere near it. Nowhere near it. And yeah, so it could separate your legs from your body, but that's why he wasn't anywhere f***ing near it, see? And that's why it's a test, right? It's called a test. But this guy quits, really. He goes and gets himself a shrink who gets him on comp because he had a traumatic experience. Like a soldier. Like from f***ing Iraq. But all those air gunners from Lakeside, you know, they wake up screaming most f***ing nights. No sh*t, they do. And then they go back to work the next day and they kill themselves 100 more cows. And you remember that day when we were out there and the oil carried over, shot out the stack and the whole lease went up? And you and I, we stood at the tank and f***ing worked in that, with all that fire behind us? And yeah, you pissed yourself. So what? You pissed yourself because you didn't have a choice. Because that's what work is, right?
Yeah, I really, really like this poem, and I think it's because it feels so real. It feels like there really is a guy named Dave, and even if there's not really a guy named Dave, there are lots of guys like Dave.
Yeah, there is a guy named Dave, and there are a lot of guys named Dave, and this is what I've done a lot of the time in this book is I've kind of taken the personalities of four or five people and turned them into one, but there are a lot of these guys out here, and I've had this conversation a few times probably.
And is it a conversation you like to have?
I mean, it's interesting because I'm coming from two different worlds toward this now. There's a part of me that thinks like, yeah, that is work. That's what it is. You know that when you sign up that there's going to be this danger. And then there's the other part of me that says, you know, if a guy can't take that danger, absolutely he should go and see a shrink. And it's the coming together of those two worlds that really intrigues me, which I think is what drew me toward writing this poem.
And is there some machismo or macho-ness about, you know, a guy that would have to see a shrink and he should just accept that this is dangerous work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anyone who's been a part of any kind of male-dominated world is familiar with this kind of machismo, I think. This idea of, like, the hyper-masculine, the super tough. And a lot of the time, it's people reaching toward that ideal, you know, of doing things like in this poem where he talks about, you know, one guy peeing himself but staying there and working. It's reaching toward that. It means, you know, it's not that you're not frightened. It's not that things aren't difficult. It's just that you do it anyway. And I think that's what, you know, a character like this is trying to get at.
One of the guys I interviewed in North Dakota was a roughneck from Montana, and I got to talking to him about the stickers on the back of his pickup. And one of his stickers said, you know, I'd rather F, fight, or trip pipe. And he said that his stickers were sort of not just an embodiment of sort of his attitude towards the world. It was basically also he needed to show other roughnecks how tough he was, that he wasn't a guy that should be messed with. So, you know, in that comment, it made me think that, you know, there's obviously some of this, well, I've got to just show the other guy how tough I am.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you never want to be the guy who turns down work or who doesn't do something. It's also that kind of attitude that makes things dangerous sometimes, right? I know that I've seen people, you know, doing jobs without the right safety gear or things like that, but no one wants to be the person who is that kind of, you know, perceivably weaker voice of reason who says, no, I don't want to do this. We don't have a safety line or, you know, something like that. So there's definitely that sense where you can't ever be the weakest one on crew. You can't ever be the weakest one on lease.
All right, let's meet somebody else. Why don't we meet a guy named Gary?
Gary. December 25th is 60 hours long. double time and a half to let his kids call Santa Daddy. The wife wears Sears diamonds under the collar of her house coat, drinks Starbucks homebrew, and goes barefoot all day, waiting for the 6 p.m. shake of a one-ton in her driveway. The kids remember him mostly by his smell. If you asked them to guess, they'd say something between Walmart packaging and the garage floor. Some days he comes home to silence, sits at the table in covies or dirty jeans, feels his house surround him, the plasma screen, doilies, angels on the wall, lets his gut fall to his lap, waiting for someone to finally find him out.
That was Matthew Henderson reading from his book of poems called The Lease, and that poem is called Gary. The Lease is published by Coach House Books in Canada, and I'm sure you can find it at your local bookstore, or if not, order it online. This is Prairie Public. I'm Todd Melby. I'm the Black Gold Boom oil reporter. And Matthew, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was this this notion of blue-collar voices in poetry. Dwight Garner, when he reviewed your book in the New York Times, he said that that these distinctive blue-collar voices remain a rarity, especially in our poetry. Why do you think that is?
I think that a lot of the time when people turn to poetry, they're doing it to try and experience something different. Poetry is a place where ambiguity is often beautiful, and it can lead you to think and understand things. And a lot of the time, the workplace, particularly the blue collar workplace, is somewhere where ambiguity is really not favored. So there are some natural conflicts between, I think, poetry and this kind of like working class world. And then I think that it might be that it's the way that poetry is presented and kind of marketed, spoken about, is that people who might have an interest in this kind of blue collar world, as you put it, don't realize that poetry is something that there's any value in being interested in. They're being told that it's not for them. So I think that contributes to the, kind of the lack of blue collar poetry.
Yeah, so poetry is seen as this sort of upscale literary thing, as opposed to something that that everybody can enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the poems that we are exposed to are things that we are told aren't very accessible, straight from school to anywhere else. You know, and particularly if you look at the movements of poetry in the last, 30, 50 years, as we move toward more conceptual poetry, which is, you know, an excellent thing in its own right. But as we move toward that, and it's maybe using language in a different way, language in a way that isn't as easily accessible, people can begin to feel as if it's something that isn't meant for them, as if they aren't supposed to understand or approach.
Well, let's finish with one more poem from Matthew Henderson and his book, The Lease. Let's finish with a poem called Joe Talks About Snubbing.
Joe talks about snubbing. Most dangerous job in the patch, really. I won't even do it. Clint, you know Clint? He lost his soup on a snub job, his first week of fieldwork, too. Clint told me the rig burned so hot they had to pry bones from the metal. That's a close casket, boy. Rough service. Rough. But yeah, it's tripping under pressure, basically pushing pipe down a hole that wants to push you back. So when the patch itself gets so goddamn angry, but you don't remember the rest. You can only think of Joe's elbows on the table, dirty or freckled, when he told you to avoid the nipple.
That's Matthew Henderson reading from his book, The Lease. Let me ask you this question about the oil patch. You've been away from it for how many years now?
It'll be 3 years, 3.5.
And do you ever miss it? Do you ever want to go back?
Sometimes I miss it. You know, I'm a college teacher now. I'm teaching English. And when I've got that stack of papers and it just seems like they won't go anywhere, and you're marking or you're standing up in front of a class talking, I miss the physical exertion. I miss knowing that I would leave in the morning, and when I came back at night, I'd be tired and know that I had done some work, and have that feeling in my body like I've accomplished something. Be able to look out at a lease and see the equipment that we moved in that day and see how something is different. Something's not like it was before, and know that I did that. There's a real sense of accomplishment that comes with physical labor that I definitely miss.
All right, Matthew Henderson, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Todd.
That's Matthew Henderson. His book is called The Lease. It's published by Coach House Books in Canada. And he worked in the oil fields in Western Canada, and he now teaches poetry in Toronto.
And once again, that is Todd Melby. He is the Black Gold Boom reporter and producer. Time now for the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Minnesota House and Senate are expected to have floor debates this week on a solar electricity mandate. The House bill would require investor-owned utilities to have 4% of their electricity sales come from solar by 2025. The Senate's version has a 1% figure. Rural co-ops and municipal power systems would be exempted from those requirements. Michael Noble with the nonprofit group Fresh Energy says that means much of Greater Minnesota will not see the benefits.
Even though it's bad public policy to leave the co-ops and muni utilities behind and exempt them from laws, it can still be a very strong bill if Xcel Energy and Minnesota Power are forcefully and strongly moving toward clean, renewable energy.
Utilities say solar electricity is very expensive and their customers should not be required to buy it. Minnesota House and Senate lawmakers are trying to reconcile their separate versions of a Health and Human Services budget. Among the provisions in the bill where there are differences is how much funding should go to Minnesota food shelves. State Senator Melissa Franzen authored her chamber's legislation for food shelf funding. She says 40% of those helped are children, and use is at an all-time high.
Just in 2012, what I was told is that over 3 million visits were made to food shelves. So that's just 1 year. And the other piece is, you know, food shelves are vital to families in need.
The bill passed by the House would provide about $2.5 million for food shelf funding over the next 2 years. The Senate version would increase that to $3.5 million. It's estimated that about 1 in 10 households in the state are food insecure. And Senator Heidi Heitkamp returned from congressional delegation trip to Central Asia over the weekend. Heitkamp visited Turkey, Syria, Afghanistan, and Pakistan with other U.S. senators over a seven-day trip. The delegation met with several officials to discuss the importance and appreciation of strong relationships with the United States. Heitkamp says she also got to meet with soldiers from North Dakota. She says military forces are confident in the strides made within the region.
We spent a lot of time with folks, including some of the security folks that work for the State Department, who were able to really say, this is day and night now compared to where we were 5-6 years ago in Afghanistan. And a lot of those folks were, in fact, on the front lines in the very early stages. And I think they have seen tremendous progress.
Pakistan will hold its first democratic election in history on Saturday, which Heitkamp says is a huge step. She says the elections will have a profound impact on the regional political relationships and in the transitional efforts in Afghanistan as well. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tomorrow, there will be another Science Cafe in downtown Fargo. This one is featuring the questions about art, how you can maintain it and make it look as good as it did when it was created, or for that matter, keep it from going away forever. This is Science and Art Conservation is the name of this Science Cafe. It's scheduled for 7 to 8:30 p.m. Tuesday at the Hotel Donaldson's Stoker Lounge. It's free and open to the public, but of course attendees have to be 21 or older because of where it is or accompanied by a parent or guardian. Now, joining me to talk about this is the fellow who'll be giving the talk, Stuart Kroll, a professor in the Department of Coatings and Polymeric Materials. So let's start with the definition of what a coating is and what a polymeric material is, if it's in any way different.
Well, polymeric materials are commonly part of the composition of a coating. Now, the way most people understand coatings is think of paint. I mean, a coating can be anything that's a shielding or a decorative surface on top of something else. But commonly, we apply those as paints. And so if you think of paints, you've got most of it.
And I would suspect that in your discipline, most of this is probably to protect something as opposed to make it look great?
Yes or no. It's both. Coatings make cell phones look sparkly and glamorous, and they make cars look just as perfect as anything, so we want to buy them. So appearance has a huge role in what coatings function is.
And NDSU has a pretty strong department in this area. It's pretty well known. How did you get to it?
Well, I've been in the paints, if you like, industry, or had been in the paints industry for a long time. And I'd known about the department almost ever since I joined the industry. And then 13 years ago, they asked me for about the third time whether or not I wanted to become a professor. And I thought, well, since I'd just been downsized out of industry, that it might not be a bad thing to try. So I came in 2000.
Well, let's talk a bit about the nature of the discussion on Tuesday night at the HODO, Science and Art Conservation. You maintain right away that you're not an art conservator.
No.
But you've obviously been asked your opinion about how to protect works of art. So how did you get involved in that?
Oh, actually, it goes back more years than I would normally care to confess, actually. But since I've been at NDSU, we were addressed by in fact, Gordon Bierwagen and I were sitting at a paint show booth for the department, and two youngish gentlemen came up and said, "Do you know anything about paint?" And we said, "Well, of course we do."
it's my life.
Yes. One was from the Tate Gallery in England, and one was from the Getty Institution in Los Angeles.
Wow.
And they were starting a project about how to treat modern art. Now, you have to understand that modern art has been around since the end of the Second World War. So it's not as new as you would think, and a lot of it is in dire need of repair and restoration itself. And they were both scientists. One was a spectroscopist and one was a chromatographer, and they wanted to understand what we understood about the composition of the paints that the artists would have used in so-called modern art.
And what were they using?
Well, they use a horrible mixture. I mean, they used house paint.
Mm-hmm.
Car paint,
okay.
Various industrial paints, and of course, as is traditional with artists, things they mixed up themselves.
So stuff that looked good at the time but might not have passed the test of time, I guess.
Well, yes. I mean, artists don't have an industrial or technological background in the whys and wherefores of how to do the best job of painting something, and they have completely different ambitions about the appearance of the painting. They're all about texture. They're all about appeal. Very much of what, the paint industry does is try to even out texture, make surfaces nice and smooth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that occasionally interests artists, but not all the time. And they would mix paints together that absolutely horrified me at the time. If you spray sort of car paint on the top of house paint, then in a few months or a year, you're going to have terrible problems with it. But they did it. And they produce something artistic, and so people have to understand the materials and then what they can do to fix the problems that have now shown up.
So what kinds of problems were you dealing with? You're talking about one example, car paint over something else.
Well, there are several, and I'll talk about them, of course, tomorrow night. But many paints, at some part of their lives, become or are soft. So dirt sticks to them. They retain fingerprints.
Mm-hmm.
If you mix two paints together, an artist, when he mixes oil paints, generally speaking, is mixing one color of oil paint with another color of oil paint, which is fine. If you mix or try to mix house paint with car paint, then you have essentially an incompatible mixture, and it might look all right for the first few hours or days, but gradually it will separate out and crack and peel off and all sorts of horrible things.
The person who owns that piece of art has a decision to make. Did this aging process, this cracking that happened, is that part of the art, or do I want to get back to where it looked when they applied the material first of all?
Well, actually, that's a really good point. Mostly conservation is opposed to restoration. So it's not like trying to refurbish or
make it look new again.
66 huh? Mustang or whatever it was, uh-huh. By replacing the body panels with fiberglass and all the rest of it. Now, the idea is you keep as much as possible of the original artwork. So you essentially, any restoration you do, and they have strict rules about that, you restore it to its current appearance. So if there's a crack, you fill in the crack so that it looks like the material on both sides of the crack. You don't try and make it look like new.
Mm-hmm.
So you're preserving the artwork, whatever it might be, and you're preserving the original artist's intent, whatever that might have been.
Uh-huh. So is this generally done with the owner of the piece or with the artist or with both?
Usually, of course, it's with the owner. Many of the original artists have passed, of course, even in the case you've got there.
I'm just wondering if they would have a different opinion.
Yes and no, and I've heard of some examples where the original artist got involved with the piece, whatever it was, and they have. There was one case I heard about with I think it was a Tate Gallery, although I might be making a mistake. They had a piece of sculpture there that was painted by the original artist, and it faded. And the original artist came back and painted it with a different paint. You see, the original artist, and by the museum's standards, destroyed the value of the art.
Wow.
Because it wasn't the original artwork.
Huh.
Honestly, that sort of thing slightly confuses me, but there are two recognizable camps in art conservation, basically.
Well, let's talk about a number of different issues that can occur with artwork. You've got them in your presentation tomorrow. Aging.
Yes.
We talked about some cracks and the yellowing or the changing of the color.
Yes.
How do we protect against that?
Well, yellowing, honestly, is very difficult because it's a function typically of the material in the painting and something like light. And it's impossible to keep light completely away from a painting because you need to see it, right? So you just have to accept as a matter of fact, really, that artwork 2 centuries later is not going to look the same as it did to start with.
What should we know about light, the nature of light? Are there some kinds of light that are less injurious?
Oh, yes. And in fact, the warning you get about not using flash in a gallery is a very valid restriction. It's just like our skin. The radiation we get from the sun that's in the ultraviolet is much more damaging to us, our skin, and paintings than the part that's in the visible spectrum. Mm-hmm. But even some of the wavelengths in the visible spectrum are bad enough. Heat is not a good thing. I mean, all chemical reactions go faster at higher temperatures. So if you can keep everything nice and cool, that's good. Moisture often plays a role in either the sort of physical cracking problems or in the chemical attack that goes on. And so you need to control humidity. Pollution. We emit all sorts of ghastly chemicals, and they're usually pretty aggressive and will change the chemistry of the artwork and thus the appearance.
And the handling. We
yes.
have oil on our hands.
Yes, I've got an example in the
right.
of when some porters picked up a painting by the edges. They clearly weren't wearing their white gloves,
mm-hmm.
and so they left dirty fingerprints.
You mentioned earlier that the difference between conservation and restoration, that they are distinctly different in terms of the way you apply them. Remind us that difference again.
Conservation, you preserve as best you can everything of the original. Restoration, there's a whole spectrum of the definition of restoration, but basically at one end, I restore plumbing. I don't conserve plumbing, you know, in my house.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to restore something and make it look like new, then depending on which sort of field you're in, you're allowed to change sort of seat covers, steering wheel covers, parts of cars and that sort of thing and make it look as good as new. That's not the objective with art conservation. You want to preserve the artwork as best you can as it is.
So minimize the change.
Yes, absolutely.
And
don't do any change you can't undo.
Okay. What should we know about cleaning an art surface? I have a painting at home, and it's an acrylic painting. It's not an oil painting. What should I do to keep it clean?
Well, keep dirt away from it. But that's part of the science of conservation. Many conservators have a huge and very practical knowledge about cleaning surfaces. They have to understand, well, you should eventually understand, of course, how to remove the dirt, but without removing any part of the artwork underneath mm-hmm. that. Varnish is allowed to be removed because even the original artist thought of that as a somewhat temporary but protective layer and not really part of their original art. So you need to understand how to dissolve the varnish off and leave the original artwork. So you hope, of course, that the varnish is a different enough composition that you can do something to that and not affect.
Is it usually the case that it is different enough? That
many times it is. Sometimes, of course, it's not.
And they need somebody who knows polymers and coatings, I suppose, to make that determination.
Yes.
Okay.
But as I said, I mean, in many ways, conservators, the people who actually repair and clean things, have a tremendous knowledge of cleaning materials that we mainly never bother with in our department.
What can you give me an example of a project you've been called in on to for a major restoration or conservator decision? I mean, something that Stuart Kroll had to make a decision about?
Oh, I very carefully steer away from any major decisions about artwork. Okay. Well, because the art conservators and the gallery or museum owners have that, all those rights. But I've got involved with the Smithsonian. They have oil paintings, and in some parts of the oil painting, in a single picture, you can have particularly brown regions which are very wrinkled and flaky, and white regions, of course, painted at the same time, but with different pigments that are perfectly intact.
Mm.
You can have, I've got an example there of a black paint over two areas of a white paint. Over the white paint, which was which had zinc oxide in it, the black paint has become flaky and brittle. And where the black paint is over the white, which was pigmented with lead white, it's fine.
Mm.
So that actually got me involved in some rather complicated chemistry and physics in order to help them understand what was going on. And when they originally called me about it and told me about the problem, I hadn't got a clue.
When you look at paintings with your knowledge of the materials that are applied to the canvas or the wood or the metal or the glass, what kind of paint do you prefer? Do you like oil paint, or do you like acrylic, or do you like a latex? What's your preferred pigment?
Oh, pigments are the coloring agents. I don't really have a preferred paint. I've been in the industry for a long time, and now I teach about it. And I realize, I mean, I think I appreciate the value of all different types of paint. This involvement in this world has taught me to value the craftsmanship that artists have I may hate the artwork because it's just a picture that doesn't resonate at all with me, but I can appreciate the craftsmanship that went into the design and execution of the artwork. So I don't really have a preference for paint. I just can appreciate a lot more other things about art than I used to appreciate.
When you go into a gallery, is Stuart Kroll looking at the art, or is Stuart Kroll looking at the what's happening to it?
Both, I'm ashamed to say. Well, I've been a scientist for a very long period, and I think I probably lean that way in any case, so I tend to view the world that way.
Okay. What is your preferred art? I mean, what do you like to look at?
Oh, I like all sorts of art. I mean, I like the representational art of the old masters. I like the sort of slightly romantic Victorian art. But I also like some of the modern geometrical art. It's just a question of what resonates at the time. I don't exclude anything. But
Well, one of your pieces of your presentation will deal with the Sod Buster, which
yes.
was an iconic sculpture created by Luis Jimenez, the late Luis Jimenez, that was in downtown Fargo.
Yes.
I think it was made of acrylic or something. It was made of plastic or fiberglass?
Well, it was a fiberglass shell painted with enough layers of automotive car paint to get all the shading and colors that he wanted.
And did that create problems for the piece?
Yes and no. Typically, we expect car paint to last, back then probably it wasn't 10 years, but it would have been at least a handful or more years. But that piece was out in the sun and the Fargo environment for longer than that, and it eventually deteriorated to the extent that they had to bring it in, and now they've got to study to find out how to restore it, basically.
And that's the Plains Art Museum is working on coming up with a plan make it put it on display again.
Yes, they were very kind. They allowed me into the basement to look at it in its current state and, in fact, take pictures of it.
And what would your recommendations be for it? Or what have they asked you how to go about whatever process they need to go through to
Well, yes and no. I've discussed it with Mark Ryan, there, but I won't have the final say or any real input because I'm A, not a conservator, and B, don't own the thing.
Good.
But it's a very large piece, and it's going to require a lot of effort and a lot of, I have to say this, a lot of money to restore it.
And it was created in 1982, so yes. It's not even that old by art standards, I
well,
guess.
Well, no, but I mean, if you consider just by reference to normal things we own, most car paint only lasts 10 or a dozen years, even now. Our boat hulls, which are made of fiberglass in exactly the same way, this the underlying material of the sculpture, and they tend to go white and chalky after not very many years. So it's the same materials. And the steel reinforcing inside the piece that sort of holds it in shape, that was very near a lot of road salt. And, of course, that's corroded rather badly.
Oh, wow.
And okay. The train tracks just to the north of it, those great big coal trains and grain trains, there's a lot of vibration.
So there's more to it than meets the eye.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It strikes me that the sort of the subtext of what you're saying is that whether it's a car or a cell phone or a piece of art, that it really only exists at in the state the artist or the craftsman or the designer intended momentarily.
Well, yes.
Because from then on, it's deteriorating.
Yes. We were born once, weren't we?
We were indeed.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming by and revealing some of the issues with conserving art, some cases restoring it. And we want to mention again that your Science Cafe is Tuesday evening, 7 o'clock, at the Hotel Donaldson in downtown Fargo, specifically Stoker's Lounge, 21 or older, accompanied by a parent or guardian. And it includes a presentation by Professor Kroll, a discussion. You can actually ask questions of the professor.
Yes,
and maybe even come to some decisions about some art that you might have in your home. Are you asking people to bring anything by? Are you going to look at stuff or just talk to them about this?
No, I'm not looking for conservation jobs. But actually, if there are any conservators in the region, I'd be very glad to find them. I tried Googling, of course, the usual things, and didn't come up with anybody in this neighborhood. The closest I could find was somewhere in the Twin Cities.
All right. Well, tomorrow, the Science Cafe at the HODO, Stuart Kroll. Be there and learn about maintaining your art. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Attorney Daniel Buchanan of Buchanan Law Office in Jamestown, specializing in elder law and estate planning. Information on these and other legal matters is available at 252-6604.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 6th. The LZ-129 Hindenburg airship caught fire, exploded, and crumpled from the sky on this date in 1937. The German airship disaster made headlines around the world, not only due to the horrific nature of its destruction, but also because of the spectacular newsreel coverage and the mystery surrounding the cause of the fiery crash. The Hindenburg was actually only one of an entire fleet of airships named after Field Marshal and former President of Germany, Paul von Hindenburg. The specific airship involved in the disaster, the LZ-129, was the lead ship of the Hindenburg class. The ships were manufactured by the Zeppelin Company in Germany beginning in 1931 and were first used by the Nazis to distribute propaganda over the occupied Rhineland region in 1936. Because of the relative expense and scarcity of non-flammable helium, the Zeppelin Company chose to use the flammable hydrogen gas in the airship's inner balloons. For a full year, the LZ-129 ferried passengers across the Atlantic, making regular trips to both the United States and South America. On the evening of May 3rd, the airship left Frankfurt for a transatlantic flight to Lakehurst, New Jersey. When it arrived on May 6th, landing crews began preparing for its descent by lowering anchor ropes from the bow and stern. Within seconds, the airship caught fire and exploded, killing 36 and injuring dozens more. Because it was the maiden flight to the United States that year, several journalists were on hand to record the landing. The disaster has continued to fascinate the public for decades, and dozens of authors have written books on the subject. One such book, Fire in the Sky, was written by Washburn, North Dakota native Jessica Gunderson. Gunderson has written dozens of children's graphic novels on historical subjects, including Sacagawea, Lewis and Clark, the Chinese Empire, and the Silk Road. She obtained a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from Minnesota State University in Mankato and now lives in Madison, Wisconsin, where she continues to write. As for the Hindenburg, a group of European scientists recently announced, in March of 2013, that after all these years, they finally solved the mystery of the explosion, blaming static electricity for the disaster. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jamie Jobe. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street, in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
And then our minute or so left with Main Street Today, just a little update in the information about the Science Cafe. You can be younger than 21 and go, even, I guess, without a parent or guardian. They're opening it wide open, so Stoker's Cafe or Stoker's Lounge in the Hodo tomorrow for the Science Cafe about art conservation. Also tomorrow on Main Street, the Great Plains Young Professional Summit is coming up in Bismarck. One of the important discussions will be a panel on North Dakota 2.0. That's a statewide initiative that explored North Dakota's future. We'll get an update and a preview of the presentation from Jasper Schneider. He's the state director of the USDA Rural Development, and Rod Backman, chair of the State Census Committee. And we'll also hear about a new American story from producer Erica Lorenzen. That's all coming up tomorrow on Main Street. In the meantime, you have a great evening.